The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. Sam, a very busy Saturday for you with J1 back up and running, but you wouldn't have it any other way, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely not. It was great to have it back. I look forward to going back to work on Friday ahead of the fixtures. And then, yeah, it was manic Saturday morning over here. But, yeah, great to have it back.
Terrific stuff. And joining us for a full review of J1 Match Day 2, just as he did after the first round all the way back in late February, is Sean Carroll. Sean, how are you?
Yeah, very good. Cheers, mate. How are you?
I'm terrific, thanks. Now, to you both, I don't know how you've gotten on in Tobias Dreiman and Jeff Osborne's J1 predictions game over there on Transfer Market. I'm actually terrified to check the results. I think I've done horribly in the first round of games that count, obviously in match day two. Sam, how did you get on?
I'm not 100% sure on the last results, but I definitely was doing best in J3, then J2, and J1 was my worst, so I think I may have to switch podcasts.
I see. Sean, do you care to share how you got on in said prediction contest?
I'd love to, but I honestly haven't got a clue. I did them. I've done all four leagues because I just thought, why not? And it would be a good way to kind of try and learn a little bit about JFL and J3, which I don't have much knowledge at all on. I went through and got all the predictions put in the middle or towards the end of last week, and I haven't gone back to check yet. The website can be slightly difficult to navigate at times. It was quite tricky to find my way to it, to the prediction page, and I'm a bit scared to go back and try and find them. Not because I'm right about how wrong or right I was, but just if I can actually find the page I'm looking for. But yeah, I'll have to check once I hang up here and see. But I don't think I did very well. I don't tend to do very well. I had an accumulator on some J2 games at the weekend too, and one of them was I went for Albrex Niigata to win against Cannizzaro, and they lost 5-3 at home. So, yeah, I don't intend to.
Fair enough then. Well, yeah, if you're intrigued by our chat there at the start of the episode, listeners, you can get in touch with Tobias or Jeff on Twitter. Tobias is at Kondrai, and Jeff is at Okinawa Aussie, and yeah, they can walk you through the steps of getting set up. Don't worry if you're starting from match day three, if you're a week behind, because yeah, you certainly won't have to catch up too many points to me, I don't think. So yeah, we'll wait and see till all the results come in, but yeah, not very positive. And it is called a betting game, but yeah, regular listeners will know that Sam and I have absolutely no confidence in our predictions and would certainly never want to bet on them. So yes, it is purely a predictions game just for the fun of it. And yeah, J1 returned on Saturday with a full slate of 9 games in match day 2. So without any further ado, let's get cracking. There are a couple of candidates for match of the round, but last week we kicked things off in our preview with Alan Gibson by talking about the Osaka Derby. So that's probably a good place to start our review, Sam, because a fair bit happened at the Panasonic Stadium Suita, and ultimately the visitors Cerezo returned to their home base with all 3 points after a 2-1 win.
Yeah, it was a sort of game where if someone was new to the J-League and asked me to tell them what Cerezo Osaka were like, I'd show them this game, because they didn't have a lot of possession. They just sat back, defended quite well, didn't overexert themselves at all really on any counter-attacks, but were quite clinical in the end and got the result. And it's just kind of what Cerezo do, and they're carrying on from last season. I thought Gamba they didn't really create too much. I think like the post through Osami, but it was a deflected effort. Then they eventually got back into the game with a penalty. But yeah, there wasn't much of a cutting edge from Gamba, and Cerezo were fairly comfortable, I'd say. And the best moment of the game was Murahashi's goal. It comes to him, edge of the area, knocked back by Kiyotake, and it's a rasping effort into the far corner. He's got a few of those in his locker, and this was another really good effort from him. And I think Cerezo were worth the victory, but I mean, we gave it the billing last week, and I mean, it was a decent game, but it was one of these games where teams were just feeling their way back into it, which you've seen in various leagues around the world coming back to these empty stadiums. So yeah, I think it was a decent game, and I think Cerezo played as Cerezo do and were worthy of the points.
Fair enough then. So, yeah, Sam's mentioned Yusuke Murahashi's goal for Cerezo. It was their second of the evening. It came just past the hour mark after Maruhashi had set up Hiroaki Okuno for Cerezo's opener in first half stoppage time. And, yeah, Sean, I mean, there's often, you know, differing opinions on what a goal of the season should look like. But for me, I know we're only two rounds in, but for me, that is absolutely the clubhouse leader, an absolute rocket from 25 yards from Maruhashi, who, as Sam says, has that kind of thing in his locker. Every now and then you see a bit of magic from his left foot, and that was just an absolute perfect indication of it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's, you know, people have different opinions as to what constitutes. Is it a team goal? Is it, you know, every player getting a touch? Is it a dribble where someone goes past eight players? But I think, you know, you can argue that sometimes those are the kind of goals that are the most satisfying. When someone hits it and you know the second it's left their boot that it's going in, and it just rifles, whether it's on the deck as his was, whether it's a volley or something from a corner. Like, there's just some goals where it's, you know, when they're really hit with power and just rifle in, there's something incredibly incredibly pleasing about watching them. And yeah, as you said, I think probably from the goals I remember seeing so far this season, that has to be up there as one of the standouts for sure.
So it was a milestone evening for Gumba icon Yasuhito Endo, without question one of, if not the best player in J-League history. He became the record appearance holder in the top flight by making his 632nd appearance. He started the game, came off just before Marahashi's goal, actually, in the 54th minute. So, yeah, what Gumba hoped would be a banner occasion to celebrate Endo's milestone ended in defeat, but they did make a game of it somewhat after going 2-0 down through Ad Milson's penalty after a Kosuke Onose's low blast hit the arm of a prone Yasuki Kimoto, and the referee pointed to the spot. But yeah, with 20 minutes left to find an equaliser, Sam, as you said, this was just classic Cerezo, wasn't it? They were able to hold Gumba pretty much at arm's length for the rest of the way.
Yeah, they were very comfortable. Their defence is just so well organised, with Jonic and Kimoto or Seko, whoever starts in that back line. And then they're just so regimented in front of them as well. And it was difficult, really, for Gamba to pick a way through. They didn't really create any sort of glorious chance to equalise. And I think it's just what Cerezo Osaka do. And I think Scott was mentioning it last week, that teams like Cerezo, like Tokyo Sanfrecce, will kind of benefit from the way the setup is at this season, with the extra games, the lack of crowd maybe. And I think they just showed here. I thought Cerezo were, yeah, really comfortable, even at 2-1.
What do you reckon, Sean? Could this be... we don't want to make it... Well, we have made title predictions in the lead-up to the season, but what do you think? Is Cerezo the sort of side that might be able to ground their way to, you know, a decent position with, say, 10 games to go, and from there, obviously, it's anyone's cup of tea?
In an ordinary season, I'd probably say no, just because I don't think they've got quite enough game changers that can shift games that are going towards a 0-0 or a 1-0 defeat. Like, you know, Marinos last year had two or three in the pack that would just come up with something out of the blue. But yeah, the teams that win it do tend to have players who can turn stuff. And you look at them, and they're a solid squad. They're workmanlike. They've got, you know, they've got quality players, obviously. But I would say in an ordinary season, maybe not. But yeah, this year, I mean, it's just impossible to call. There's just so many other factors. The schedule is insane. The tiredness that's going to creep in, the injuries that are going to creep in, the lack of motivation for at least a third of the division that is going to be playing for absolutely nothing. It's just so hard to call. So yeah, this year, without, you know, with the exception of maybe that six or seven teams that you think will be down near the bottom, pretty much anyone could win it, because it's such a mess of a format, I think.
Yeah, fair enough then. Oh, so, okay, so Sam, just a quick word on Gumba before we move on then. Yeah, obviously, as I said, they would have loved to have won this for Endo on his milestone appearance. But, first and foremost, they wanted to win the derby for themselves and for Osaka bragging rights. You said in the green room that, this was the game that you watched live and occupied most of your attention on Saturday evening our time, Saturday morning / early afternoon your time. So, what did you make of... I don't want to go through every single game and talk about what the atmosphere was like inside the stadium with no supporters, but obviously Suita has gotten so many raps in its, three or four years since it's opened. Was it noticeable for you, the lack of supporters? Did Gumba pipe crowd noise in? Did they try and decorate the seats? I mean, what sort of an atmosphere could they create? Did they try to create with no supporters? And are you disappointed in Gumba that they didn't make more of this occasion and build on that opening day win against Yokohama, keeping in mind the caveats that, they were all starting over again?
Well, it's difficult for me to say, really, because I'm not sure what feed, if I got the same feed on UK TV as you would have done over in Japan, because I know Alan was tweeting that there were some piped crowd noise in, but I couldn't hear any of it on my feed, so it was really noticeable that there was no crowd there and it was just... it was a weird atmosphere, and I think you could tell that the players weren't really had nothing to react to, so they weren't really up for it. No one was as much as you would be in a normal derby game, and it just didn't seem to have that energy, at least at the start. It did come in a little bit once for the second half after Cerezo had taken the lead. But, it was just a weird atmosphere, and it's going to be difficult for Gamba as the home team. You lose that advantage in a derby game. They've got such a good record against Cerezo. It's quite surprising to see them lose a derby, but I don't know if that affected them. There was something missing. There wasn't the same spark that there was on match day one when they beat Yokohama. And it's difficult to point your finger on it. I think they've got a very good squad. They've got so many good players. Once Shoji comes back, he can add Idaguchi to that midfield. So I don't worry about them. I just think it was one of those days. They're a little bit off. The conditions probably didn't help them. But, I think I'd like to see a bit more going forward, and I'm sure there will be.
Fair enough, then. Well, it is actually back-to-back Osaka Derby wins for Cerezo, because they won the second meeting last year at home. So they have retained the Osaka Championship belt, and they'll take that into their meeting at the Yanmar Stadium in the second half of the season. All right, so Sean, we didn't begin this episode by calling it Overreaction Theatre, as we did to our episode after match day one, because I didn't really think there were that many surprising results along the lines of Kawasaki 0, Tosu 0, and the aforementioned Yokohama 1, Gumba 2 on the opening day. A couple of eye-opening results for sure. But I guess for some, Kobe 0, Hiroshima 3 will have been a surprise. Was it to you?
I think it was. Not so much that Hiroshima won, because they did well. I think last year they beat Kobe both times and scored. I'm fairly certain they were fairly emphatic wins. So maybe it shouldn't have been, but I just felt that this year Kobe really improved in the second half of last year after Thorsten Fink came in. Obviously, they won the Emperor's Cup in the end. They got into the ACL. They've started fairly well in there, albeit again, 4 months ago. And I felt like Kobe were finally going to be a sort of tougher proposition this year. They looked a bit more settled. And although Hiroshima always start the season very well, and are increasingly under Hiroshi Jofuku becoming like one of the sort of the solidest opponents, the toughest teams to come up against, I think. I'm thinking maybe they might have snuck a 1-0 or maybe taken a point away. Wouldn't have been a huge shock, but the fact that they did it so comfortably and, looked so in control. I only caught the sort of last half an hour or so of it, and they never really looked under any pressure from Kobe. They looked very assured, very settled. So the win itself wasn't a surprise, but the fact that they did it so easily, and again, it might come into what you've just said about the Osaka Derby and the fact there's no fans in the stadiums at all. I wrote about it recently, and I've said it before on the pod, but I don't ever really detect a huge difference in terms of if you're playing home or away, but there's certainly a difference in playing football in front of fans or not in front of fans. And I think, maybe that could have played a part as well. And, just there's no fans there to get behind you or whatever from Kobe's point of view, and you know, you go a goal down, and watching the games, they almost look like sort of training matches, and maybe they're just subconsciously, there's just not that level of intensity, that level of pressure that normally would drive players forward when you've got 20 or 30,000 fans in the stadium making noise. I don't know, but yeah, it just all seemed a bit flat. But then at the same time, we have to acknowledge that the fact that these players haven't played for 4 months, and they're probably just trying to get back up to speed and get back up to having to be playing. Well, they've got a game again in a couple of days, so playing three games a week for the foreseeable future.
Most definitely. And terrific memory there, Sean. Hiroshima absolutely took Kobe to the cleaners twice last season. They won 4-2 at the Noivir Stadium all the way back last April in match day 7. So that stadium is very much a happy hunting ground for them. But they went 2 goals better in the home game later on in the season in match day 28. 6-2 winners at the Edion. So, that's... I'm not great at maths, but I believe that's a 10-4 aggregate over the course of the season. So, Sam, I guess it could be argued that Sanfrecce have gone easy on Vissel on Saturday, just winning by the lazy 3 goals. But, it looks to me from the highlights that Hiroshima... basically took whatever punches, as meek as they might have been, from Kobe, you know, a Douglas free kick or a couple of decent passing moves here and there, and just absolutely, took them to the cleaners and gave them an old-school lesson in effective football.
Yeah, absolutely. It was so easy for them as well. And the problem that Kobe had was Vermaelen was not in the squad, where a bit of a knock. I think he's being like, they're taking care of him more than anything else. But once you take him out of that team, the defence is dreadful. The goalkeeper's not very good, although I thought it wasn't his fault today. I'll ease up on him. But with the back three that they have, and then I don't rate Sergei Samper as a holding midfielder. I don't think he breaks play up. He's fine distributing and when Kobe out on top of a game, but I don't think he sees danger, nor does Yamaguchi, who moved back there later in the game. I think it was definitely him for the third goal, just gets brushed off it really easily, and then the Kobe defence just parts ways. And yeah, it was just like the first goal was a set piece where no one marked Heiner for the flick on, and then Goto Kosakai is not paying any attention and just plays everyone on. So it was just a really simple goal, and it was just really simple for Sanfrecce. I was surprised by the lack of kind of cut and thrust from Kobe going forward with all the quality attacking players that they do have. They really weren't tested at all, Sanfrecce, at the back. And they just, I think it helps them that they're such a well-regimented side. Everyone knows what their job is. They don't have to react to a crowd at all. They're not like a flair player. Maybe you want the crowd up and it gives you the confidence to go and do something. But when your job is very quite simple to an extent and you know exactly what you're doing, they don't have to change the way they're playing. And they've just looked really well organised. And yeah, they just have that first 11 especially is really as almost as good as anyone, just because of how well they're coached, which if I'd have said that about Hiroshi Jofuku 3 years ago, I might have been laughed at. But the way he's coached this team, it looks, a terrific starting 11. Whether they have the depth is an interesting question. It's one that Johnny Nicol actually sent in, and he asked, with them starting well and this starting 11 looking so good, do you think that either of you, do you think that they have a strong enough squad to mount a title challenge?
Again, I'd have to say similarly to Cerezo, I'm not convinced by the players they've got in the final third. I completely agree with what you've been well organised, and I think they've got to come in defence or in midfield, I think will be maybe not quite up to the same standard as the ones who are starting in their what you call their best 11. But the looking at the attack, like I still don't particularly rate Douglas Vieira. I think he's steady enough, but he's not gonna. I can't see him getting into the high double figures, which is what I think you need if you want to win the league. They've brought in Yor Nagai as well, who I quite like as a player, but again, I don't think he's scored. But I'm not really sure they've got enough in the squad as a whole to make a challenge over the course of the season. But yeah, I think in terms of the the organisation, the setup, the fact that as Sam just said, all the players know exactly what they're supposed to do, and it doesn't matter who they're playing against or what the score is in the game, they'll know what they're supposed to be doing at any given time. I think they'll certainly be up there in the top third of the table again, and they could push on for an ACL spot. But if they were to get injuries, if Leandro Pereira, say, was to get injured, or I think, maybe then Morishima or someone was to get injured, I think then you might see them kind of drop off a bit and start drawing more than they were winning. And that, obviously, as Tokyo saw at the end of last season, sorry, Ben, can be the difference between winning the title and not winning the title.
Yeah, I mean, I would never have pictured myself picking Hiroshima in the title race before the season started and before the COVID-19 enforced hiatus. But yeah, I mean, I concur with the opinion of some of our recent guests that they might be set up for this kind of season. They might fitness permitting, they might be they might play the style of football that will be very effective in situations like this, where there's so many games coming thick and fast, and they're adept at soaking up pressure and doing. I mean, this game is a perfect example. I mean, they were outpossessed, they were outshot by significant margins, but they've walked away with all 3 points after playing their style of football, and nobody could say they didn't deserve to win the game. So I can see this happening with Hiroshima numerous times throughout the season, and with the usual caveats of fitness and keeping key players upright, then I would definitely at this stage of the season back them to finish in the top six. But as we all know, once you get to say 10, 12 games to go, especially in a season like this, that if you're in that sort of a position, then it's basically anyone's league, I think. So Hiroshima, they've set their stall out most definitely, and obviously following on from a 3-0 win over Kashima all the way back on the opening day. So they topped the table after a 2 match days on goal difference ahead of FC Tokyo and Cerezo Osaka. And, they've made a terrific start. In Kobe, Leandro Pereira bagged a brace, and notably Yuya Asano, the younger brother of Japan striker Takuma, grabbed the second goal. That was his first J1 goal, so a significant milestone for him, and congratulations to Yuya. I bet Takuma would have been on the line sending his congratulations right after the game. So that's events from the Nova Stadium wrapped up. And Johnny, thanks for your question on Hiroshima. We'll be hearing from Johnny again, chatting about some of the young goalkeepers who made their marks in J1 match day 2 a little bit later on. So let's move from the Kansai area back to Kanto. There were some pretty heavyweight clashes on the match day 2 slate. And, I was going to talk about Reds and Yokohama next, Sam, but, I mean, that was the only goalless draw of the match day. So let's talk about a game where there were some goals and some significant talking points. Let's begin our Kanto wrap at Todoroki, where Kawasaki captain Shogo Taniguchi was involved in pretty controversial incidents at the beginning and at the very end of this game, a game that saw his Frontale side run out 2-1 victors. But when you add the significant incidents up, and you figure out that Kawasaki have come out on the better end of both of them, was this result a little bit harsh on Antlers?
Yeah, definitely. I think Antlers was so furious at the end of the game, and rightly so, especially with the opening goal. The penalty at the end, I don't know. It was a bit of 50-50 for me. I'm not against them not giving that one, but this first goal is so far offside. It's so obvious. And I know the debate is going to be about, should we bring in VAR again, and is it right that it's been dropped for this season? But you don't need that if you've got officials that are capable of their job. It was not a difficult decision by any means. It's a great ball in by Inaga, but Taniguchi is miles offside. He pokes it home, and that gives Kawasaki the lead inside the first couple of minutes, and Antlers were completely up against it. So, yeah, I think they have every right to be angry.
Yeah, fair enough. So, yeah, Sean, it was obviously very, very early doors. And, yeah, Taniguchi was left unmarked at the far post to turn in a cross from Akihiro Iyanaga. But, yeah, well, I mean, Taniguchi turned around sheepishly to check the linesman hadn't raised his flag. So he must have had suspicions he was offside himself. And, well, yeah, as Sam says, it's pretty egregious that, yeah, the linesman wasn't able to keep up with that passage of play, especially considering it came from a short corner routine, basically straight off the Frontale training pitch. So, yeah, Antlers obviously could feel aggrieved, but, well, I mean, the second goal, you can't have any arguments about Frontale going 2-0 up on the half hour when Tatsuya Hasegawa rifled in. I tell you what, if, yeah, Marohashi hadn't smashed that one in for Cerezo, this one might have been a contender, at least for goal of the match day. A crossfield pass from Iyanaga, controlled by Hasegawa with his first touch, and blasted past to Kwonsunte with his second.
Yeah, as you say, the second goal, there would be no complaints. The first one was offside, and I agree with Sam. I don't think there was much in the call for a penalty at the end. That struck me as something you see pretty much every weekend all around the world, where a team that's losing is suddenly getting desperate. And yeah, would it be given in the middle of the pitch as a free kick? Probably, but I don't think it was a penalty. It was a coming together. But yeah, the opening goal was offside, and obviously that then framed so much of how the rest of the game plays out. I just wonder if the officials, you know, obviously we've sort of touched upon the fact that the players are obviously still trying to get up to fitness, but you know, the officials too, obviously they've had to sort of readjust. They haven't been sure about what's going on, and I just wonder as well if again subconsciously, like, they were thinking this year, right, we're going to have VAR, so that gives you a kind of buffer that even if you do make an error, even if you don't quite see something, you've got the guys in the room watching the videos and being able to you know, give it a second look and save you, as it were, or back you up and say, yep, you got it right. And they've obviously been training on that in the proper off season before we started the 2020 season back in February. And I just wonder if there is a sense of, like, suddenly they're out there thinking, well, we haven't got that safety net anymore, and they're just maybe a bit nervous, a bit edgy, and just not up to, not maybe at the, you know, I wouldn't say they're not concentrating or they're not as focused, but you know, you've suddenly lost that safety net. And I think any of us in our jobs, if you were told something was changing and it was suddenly going to be a bit easier, and then just before you go back, they go, oh yeah, actually, we're not going to have that, you might suddenly be thinking, might be slightly less confident in your decisions. So I think, yeah, there's definitely, I mean, I know there's a huge amount of discussion around VAR, and a lot of people seem to be against it, but I'm firmly in the for camp. I think we need to give referees as much help as possible. The game has developed so much since, in the, you know, from 20, 30 years ago, the speed of the game, the, you know, what rests on every point for teams, the amount of money involved now and everything now, the stakes are so much higher in so many ways that I think referees need this help. It's easy for us watching on the TV to go, that was obviously off, or that was obviously a foul, or that wasn't a foul. And I think when they're out there, it's still so difficult. And yeah, the fact they haven't got the VAR this year as their safety net, I think is, yeah, obviously it's, as it goes on, you want the officials to be up to speed, and you want them to be getting the easier decisions right. But I think, yeah, that for the rest of this season, without having it with them, I think there's going to be more of those mistakes. And I think fans and players, as much as possible, are going to have to just kind of stick to the old adage of it balances out over the course of the season, and hopefully, you know, as many as that go against us will also go for us on other weekends.
All right, fair enough. Well, yeah, strap yourselves in, listeners. There will be a little bit more of our chat to come. But before then, I just want to round up the rest of the major talking points from Todoroki. So in a game that ended a 2-1 to Frontale, you might be wondering why we're not giving Kashima any credit for their goal. That's because Kawasaki scored three goals on the evening. A terrific near-post header from a corner from Leandro Damião from Juan Alano's corner. Unfortunately, though, it was past his own keeper, Jun Sung Ryong. So that was Antlers' goal, an own goal off the noggin of Damião directed the ball past Jung and cut Antlers' arrears in half. But, they were unable to fashion an equaliser, though they did come within inches late on, 5 minutes from time, the Antlers substitute Itsuki Someno's penalty area blast cannoned onto the bar and bounced basically down on the line and away from goal. And then, he was bundled over in the box by Taniguchi after chesting Yasushi Endo's superb cross in from the left. But he probably wasn't going to get to the rebound because he chested the ball basically straight into the arms of Jung. A coming together in the box. Antlers obviously felt aggrieved, and obviously after what had happened in the first couple of minutes, even more so. But yes, no penalty given by the referee, and Frontale ran out 2-1 winners. So, Sam, we'll get your VAR thoughts now. Oh, you've obviously said that, the decision for Taniguchi's goal early on in this game was frankly wrong. And, anyone with the two functioning eyes can see that you are correct in that assumption. So Alan Gibson did send us along a question, and we'll get to one of the Nagoya Grampus goals that was also at least borderline offside. Alan asks, have we accepted that VAR was going to be used and now it isn't? Does the panel think no VAR is good or bad? We were all hyped, resigned to it, and now it's not here. Is that good or bad? So I think Sean's on the record. How about yourself, Sam?
Well, first of all, the decision to not use it, because of I think it was just because the referees would be too cramped. And I don't know if the J League have ever heard of bigger rooms, but that could have easily spread them out. I don't know why that's necessarily a factor. If they came out and said, it's because we've taken a hit financially this year with the coronavirus and it's not worth it to put the money into the VAR, then I'd be more accepting. But I just thought that kind of logic was a bit flawed, in my opinion. But as for VAR, I mean, I'm not a fan of it. I'm completely against it, really. But I sit as a neutral who just wants to watch football. My team isn't going to be affected by it, at least in the J League. And I mean, I'm fairly neutral when it comes to anything else anyway. And it's not my team. I'm not going to be financially cautioned by a poor refereeing decision. So it's not really fair for my opinion to be that influential on this at all. But I think for the goal like the Taniguchi one, it should be, if it could be cleared up in 5 seconds, they look at it and then we can go move on, then it's absolutely fine. But I think when it comes to the Nagoya one, for example, it's a very tight offside call, and it's when they start bringing in these lines that they start drawing, and then he's half a toenail offside and they give it off. I don't think that's where VAR falls down for me. I just think it seems to be brought in to take away goals when I don't think anything should be doing that necessarily. I don't think the excitement should be taken away from it just by like very kind of really minute details. So that's where I am with it. If they get a system that works quickly, then yeah, absolutely fine, because the referees do need help. I think the standard of refereeing is really quite poor in Japan, and it has been for the last couple of seasons. It seems to have gotten worse. So I definitely think they do need the help. It's just whether they get a system that doesn't take away the kind of enjoyment that I have of the game and the kind of the fast-paced nature of it, just to slow it down to really excruciatingly go over a slight offside or anything like that.
All right, fair enough. Sean, would you like to write a reply, or are you happy to let us move on?
The only thing I would say is I agree to a degree about the about the fact when you do get long delays where they're debating stuff that isn't, if it's not that clear, then I do agree that you should just go with the referee's original decision and say, look, we could look at this, you know, and you've had it over the years where pundits on reaction shows will literally spend 5 or 10 minutes poring over something and everyone will come out with a different takeaway from it. And I think in those situations, you just have to go, okay, look, this is up to a subjective thing. We can't decide for sure, so we go with the original decision and carry on, and that's it. But I do think sometimes that the when people complain about things taking so long, we've had that for years, decades anyway, when players surround the referees, they're complaining, they're arguing about this decision or that decision. Like, the game does stop a lot. There are a lot of stoppages in play anyway. And so I don't really think it's too much an issue for most decisions. I think it should be restricted to game-changing decisions, which I think is what the JFA had said they were going to try and focus it on anyway for the youth in the J-League. I just think I agree with Sam that, yeah, referees need as much help as possible. And although VAR isn't perfect, I still think, as I said before, that just giving them that kind of safety net when used for the right kind of decisions, I think they need to have it with the game. The game now is played at such a pace and so different to the way it was 20 or 30 years ago that I just think they need something to help them. And I would still say that it's better to have it than not have it. And I'm assuming most Kashima and Shimizu fans would say the same after this weekend. But then after this midweek games or the next weekend, it could be Nagoya and Kawasaki fans complaining. So, yeah, I mean, football fans will never be happy. That's just one of the unwritten rules.
Yes, most definitely. All right, well, thanks very much for your question, Alan, and to Sean and Sam for your thoughts on VAR. Well, I tell you what, there was nearly a flashpoint early on in the Kashiwa FC Tokyo game as well when Michael Olunga raced clear in the fifth minute and, looked to me very much offside when he was played through on Akihiro Hayashi, but FC Tokyo were very relieved when the striker miscued his shot as the flag had stayed down. So, there might have been complaints from the Tokyo side of things if Alunga had have been able to slot past Hayashi, because he did appear to be offside, and the linesman did not appear to want to raise his flag. But that was a somewhat lucky escape for Tokyo. There was a very lucky escape for the Raysol midfielder, Richardson. Now, I don't know anything at all about this fella, but he is an absolute axe man. He was booked in the seventh minute, and 3 minutes later, basically should have been shown a straight red card. How he wasn't sent off for at least a second yellow in the 10th minute after reciting down Diego Oliveira is absolutely beyond me. Obviously, I'm addressing this game through red and blue tinted glasses, but this fella is, goodness gree. I mean, it's polite to call it a tackle. I'm tempted to call it common assault. But he was allowed to stay on the pitch. He could have given away a penalty when he clashed with Oliveira again in the 26th minute. And then 2 minutes later, Oliveira was forced from the field as a result of the initial tackle in the 10th minute. So, if Raysol set out to get their former player, well, they definitely succeeded. And Richardson somehow was able to stay on the pitch for, the next 50 minutes before he finally received his marching orders right on the hour mark, although somewhat ironically, it's probably the best tackle he made in the entire game. He actually did make contact with the ball as he lunged in on Adailton from behind, but the referee had apparently seen enough, and looked clear as day that he touched the ball, but he was shown a second yellow card, and you couldn't really say that Tokyo took the lead and ultimately won the game due to their man advantage, but they did take the lead just 2 minutes later. Masato Morishige headed down a corner from Ryoya Ogawa, and Morishige's central defensive partner Tsuyoshi Watanabe poked in from close range. It wasn't Kim Sing-gyu's finest hour. He was caught under the ball and was nowhere to be found when Watanabe basically poked in from a yard out. So that is my review of Kashiwa 0, FC Tokyo 1. Guys, I don't know if you have too much to add. I'm obviously satisfied with the fact that Tokyo have taken all 3 points from that game, but I'm not particularly satisfied with the fact that we might be without one of our major forwards for a 2 weeks to a month after this fella Richardson basically did a hit job on him. Sam, I don't know how much of this game you saw, but probably not a massive amount happened for the neutral, but from a Tokyo perspective where I see it, a positive result.
Yeah, my notes on Richardson just say walking red card. That's all I've written down on him. It was, they absolutely scythed Oliveira down, and yeah, it was ironic that it was a really good tackle that he got sent off on. But yeah, I just thought it was such a scrappy game and really feisty, and I'm not really sure why. I don't know what got up everyone at the start of the game, but yeah, there were just tackles flying in all over the place, and there was a real lack of quality. I mean, once Oliveira goes off, and then Kashua didn't have Cristiano, who is just like the forefront of their attack. He's the one that gets things going. And yeah, both teams, it was just scrappy. There wasn't much quality. And yeah, it wasn't a very good game, really, for the neutral. I think Tokyo had a few, probably the better chances. Kim made a few good saves to go with his mistake, so he sort of redeemed himself. But Kashua just, they weren't the same team that played against Consadole in match day one. They didn't really get going until they went down to 10 men and a goal behind, and they had a couple of chances after that. But yeah, it was a game that no one really deserved to win, I don't think, but Tokyo will be delighted they have done, and hopefully for them, Diego Oliveira can run off whatever injury he's got, and maybe if he's not back in midweek, maybe back at the weekend, because if you lose him for any length of time, that's, it's the forefront of your attack gone, and yeah, it's difficult to see where a lot of goals come from if Diego's not in the team.
Yeah, fair enough then. So, Sean, tell us if we're being a little bit harsh on Richardson. You will have seen him for pretty much the entire season last year in J2. So, I don't know, is he always that agricultural?
Oh, yeah, he's just an absolute liability.
Okay.
He got 11 yellow cards last year. In, what's that, a 42-game season. He's a liability. He's good, but I don't understand some of the... I mean, I messaged friend of the pod, Scott, because I'd only seen the... I hadn't seen the incident you're talking about where he should have been sent off, and I messaged him and said he should never have been sent off for that because he clearly got the ball. And then Scott said to me, yeah, he should have been sent off earlier. And I said, well, I'm not surprised to hear that because... Yeah, last year it was just like every game. Like, I don't think you can bet on yellow cards or who's going to get the first yellow card. Or I don't think you can with the place I bet through anyway. But if you could, you know, it'd be worth sticking a tenner on him every match because honestly, like, it just seems like, yeah, he thinks he's on a bonus or something for picking up those cards. Absolute liability. So it wasn't a surprise to see him get sent off. And I'd be very surprised if he didn't get into double figures for cards yellow and red combined this season. But yeah, the one that he was sent off for was absolutely not a yellow card. He got the ball. But yeah, again, this kind of goes to show, I think, that on the whole, these kind of decisions do balance themselves out. Not maybe not always in the same game as they did there, but I think over the course of the season, often the teams that end up at the top of the league were the best and the teams that end up at the bottom were the worst. And then you get these small debates that crop up. But on the whole, I think they balance out. And I think that was a good example of it. Yeah. From what I hear, like I said, I've not seen the incident, but from what Scott said and from what you guys have said there, he should have walked a lot earlier. So he got his comeuppance in the end, and I'm sure he'll get it quite a few times over the course of the season.
Yes, if you do end up checking the highlights, Sean, I think they probably come with a PG-13 rating because that is that's absolutely brutal tackle. And you say 11 yellows last year. It was only 35 appearances in J2. So yeah, he's
well, that's probably because he was suspended for so many times for getting the yellows.
So yeah, he's on 1 in 3. So I'm sure he'll want to up that ratio this season. So he's off to a good start, obviously, with the red card and just the second game of the season. But we'll follow his season with interest, how many appearances he actually makes in between suspensions. All right, well, there's probably not too many times this season that we will talk about a Yokohama FC game before a Yokohama F Marinos game. But we'll hold off on talking about the defending champions for a little bit longer and talk about their Yokohama cousins who hosted Sapporo at Mitsuzawa on Saturday. But unfortunately for them, were on the wrong end of a 2-1 scoreline. Musashi Suzuki scored a pretty tidy brace to wrap up the 3 points for Sapporo. In between his two goals, Kazunari Ichimi scored an excellent equaliser for Yokohama FC. So this game made a pretty fast start. Suzuki got his first in just the third minute, and Ichimi made it 1-1 in the 16th. And then 8 minutes into the second half, Suzuki wrapped up the points. So, Sean, I'll come back to you on this, for your thoughts on this game first. Sapporo, obviously, we've just briefly mentioned, Sam mentioned, their disappointing loss all the way back in match day one. That's obviously a distant memory for them, and they wanted to start afresh, and they've done so. And I think if you can say this has to be the year, but Musashi Suzuki surely is primed for a breakout season, and if he can stay fit, he could be the catalyst for Sapporo, maybe not finishing as high as fourth again, but definitely improving on what they did for a follow-up last year.
Yeah, I think maybe with Sapporo, it's similar to what we said about Hiroshima. It's their best 11 is good, and they're a solid top third of the table team, and then it's a bit of a lottery as to which one gets into, say, the final ACL spot, because there's usually one or two that sort of separate themselves from the chasing pack. Musashi Suzuki, I think he's a steady enough player. I don't really think he's got enough to his game. I think he still misses too many chances, and I think he's lacking some of the attributes to really kick on and establish himself as a player for the national team or to move on to a bigger or a better club, because I've just said they're going to finish in the top six. There aren't many, but I can't really see him moving on much higher. I think he's pretty much at his level. He took his goals very well. As you said, Ichimi took his goal very well as well for Yokohama, although the defence will not want to enjoy watching that back. I think they got goosed fairly easily by a pretty simple drop of the shoulder, and he didn't have much to do, although he did do very well to get round Sugino afterwards. Sapporo, they're steady. They've got a very good best 11, and they've got a couple of decent players on the bench. But as I've said with so many other teams, that it really depends on how they cope with the schedule. I think if they were to get a couple of their key players were to pick up injuries or to lose form because of tiredness, I think they would struggle. I think again they would lose games that maybe they could draw, and they would draw games that maybe they should be winning as a result of that. Obviously, Jay Bothroyd missed a very good chance to add a third, and they got away with it in this game. But there'll be other games later on in the season where if you don't wrap up the game by giving yourself, either turning a draw into a win or extending the lead when you are ahead, you might end up paying for it later on. So I think those kind of things they'll need to brush up on if they want to push on. And obviously, their manager Mihailo Petrovic is very well regarded in Japan, and he's achieved success pretty much everywhere he's gone, but it's always been up to a limit. His teams have never pushed right on and won trophies. I think except for one, I don't know if it was Levan Cup or Nabisco Cup when he won it with Reds, but I think except for that, he's not picked up much silverware, and his teams do tend to fall just slightly short. But I think they're always good to watch. They've got some very good players, and I think they'll win as many games as they lose again, and I think they should be in and around the pushing and shoving for the ACL spot come the end of the season.
Fair enough, Sam. So this was quite an interesting game from the highlights, and really obviously some good goals and some flashes from some of the Yokohama FC youngsters that we'd been looking forward to checking out, especially Koki Saito. He really did test Takanori Sugino in the 37th minute, but to be fair to Sugino, he did definitely redeem himself after getting sat on his ass by Ichimi for the equaliser. So it was good to see that veteran goalkeeper somewhat earn his keep, and obviously we're going to come on to talk about some of the younger goalkeepers in the division very shortly. So obviously plenty of talking points from this game. Unfortunately though, not an appearance from your tip for the Golden Boot Kazuyoshi Miura.
Nah, he's saving himself. Yeah. Midweek, that's his time to shine. But yeah, I don't think it'd fit in with this game. It was so free-flowing and so quick, I just think he just got lost in midfield. He needs a slower game, more to his pace, and I'm sure he'll come good. But I really enjoyed this game. I think it could have been, it might be the best game of the weekend, actually. I thought Yokohama, because they played against Kobe match day one, and they just brought the bus to Kobe and didn't really show a great deal of adventure, but they did in this game. The manager is obviously, Shimotaira, has worked on a lot of things during this break. They came out with a different formation, quite a lot of different personnel. It was quite a shock to see, I think, at the start when you've got no Yongapin or Inoue at the back, and they just went with a few more younger players. And I think it just kind of showed maybe the freedom that teams like Yokohama are going to get by not having to worry about relegation, and they can go and express themselves. And they were more than a match for Sapporo for a long period of the game, especially first half. I think the quality in the end told through from Sapporo. I think Chan's hit was terrific, and Suzuki took his goals well, and he's going to have to do that because with the way the fixtures are, Bothra is not going to be able to play every game. At the moment, Anderson Lopez is stuck in Brazil because he went home to be with his family during the virus and now can't get back into the country because of the quarantine rules and all that. So, yeah, it's a lot of things on his shoulders. But for Yokohama, they'll be disappointed to lose the game, but I thought they showed a lot of quality. I thought Fukumori won't want to watch the goal again because I don't know which direction he thinks he's going, but it was so easy for him, Ichimi, to turn, but the composure he showed in front of goal to go around the goalkeeper and finish, yeah, it was very good. And yeah, Saito looked good, and they've still got other young players that didn't really play. Matsuo didn't play in this game, so they've got more young players to come through, and I think they might not necessarily win too many games, but I think they'll be quite exciting to watch if they can continue in this sort of vein.
Yeah, absolutely terrific. And, should give Chanatip his due, of course. So, yeah, Suzuki grabs the headlines with the two goals. But, yeah, both were set up by Chanatip. The Thai maestro had a chance to make it 3-1 himself, but instead squared for the aforementioned Jay Bothroyd, who would dearly love to have that chance back, I'm sure, missed the target from inside the box. Jay will definitely have his day this season. And, Chanatip, a terrific performance from the wee man, as we have come to expect. And, the Sapporo front three, if they can all stay fit and firing, will be very much a handful for all of the top flight defences this season. And, Sam, I don't know why, you mentioning Anderson Lopez being back in Brazil made me think of Hiroto Goya. But, before we moved off the Kashiwa FC Tokyo game, I did mean to ask you both if you know anything about Goya's situation, because we did have a question from Daniel Hartman wondering where Goya was on Saturday. Of course, he was in the squad for the first game of the season all the way back at the end of February, but did not even make the bench on Saturday at home against FC Tokyo. So, Sam, I don't know, do you know anything about Goya's current situation, fitness-related, or is he out of favour with Nolsinho for all you know?
Well, as far as I can tell, there are so many attacking players at Kashiwa, so he's just going to have to wait his turn. I mean, the first two games of the season, the Levan Cup and the first league game, Hayato Nakama was out of the squad, and he was terrific in J2 last season. So as good as Goya was last season, he's just made that step up. I mean, there's only one striking berth. It goes to Olunga, and then he's got to fight it out with a few others for the bench. So I'm sure he'll get his chance, maybe even in midweek. But yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about him. I think given the way this season's going to be, he's going to get chances in the team. But yeah, it's just difficult in that team at Kashiwa to get a space in that front line. If he was a centre-back, I think he'd definitely get loads of chances, and definitely as a holding midfielder for the every other game that Richardson's out suspended. But yeah, I don't think, don't worry about Goya. I think, he'll probably be in the squad in midweek, if not next weekend.
All right, fair enough. Well, that's a pretty good answer, Sam. Thank you very much. So hopefully that satisfies Daniel. And Daniel, you can look forward to seeing, hopefully you can see Goya on a Wednesday evening, if not this coming weekend when Reysol are in action again, of course, as the games come thick and fast. All right, well, yeah, I guess if you were to list the 9 Match Day 2 games, if you were to write them down on a piece of paper and predict the results, or perhaps you had to do it for a transfer market prediction game, yeah, there's probably 8 other games you might have gone for a nil-nil result in rather than Urawa hosting a defending champions at Yokohama. But that is indeed how things panned out at Saitama Stadium on Saturday night. As you would probably expect, the Yokohama dominated possession, over 60% possession, according to the Nikkan Sports stats that I saw. But, Sean, from the highlights, what I saw was a very effective Urawa performance, not just defensively trying to restrict Yokohama, but also creating reasonable chances themselves. And this, as nil-nils go, this was probably, I don't know, in the upper echelon of entertaining ones.
Yeah, I was a bit surprised. Again, I only saw the highlights of this, and having seen the score, I thought, okay, yeah, Reds did a number and just sat back and got bodies behind the ball and sort of strangled Marinos out of the game. And I was kind of surprised at the highlights. That, as you said, both teams, Marinos had some very good chances, as you'd expect, and was proactive as always. But Reds also looked like they were playing some decent stuff. Obviously, Leonardo wasn't playing, but they still seem to have some, you know, reasonable attacking intent. I'm not personally too convinced by Yuriki. I don't think he's really up to the standard of you know, scoring double figures in J1, which I think players in that position need to be doing at a club like Reds if they want to be pushing on and challenging at the top of the table. I think he's steady enough, but nothing special. But he looked fairly lively. I thought it was a very good game. It was one of the, to be honest, of all the highlights I watched, it was probably the one game that I thought, you know, if I get time this week, I'd quite like to sit down and watch the game in full, because it looked like it was a pretty good contest. I'm just fairly certain that Nakagawa would have had a word with Eriki after the game, because there was that one, there was just that one chance where Eriki had done fantastically. He'd beaten, I think, he'd got past who was starting at right back. I know he nutmegged Deng to get into the box, but he'd got past someone. Whoever was at right back, he got past. Then he nutmegged Deng and got into the box. And Nakagawa was just stood there in front of goal, almost planning his celebration already, Kyoto Sanga style, working out, right, how am I going to do this? Waiting for the pass from Eric. And then for reasons best known to the Brazilian, he decided that he fancied trying to beat Shusaku Nishikawa from a pretty tight angle rather than just rolling the ball across for Nakagawa to tap into the net. So I think I only saw the highlights. So from what I saw of the highlights, I think Marinos probably deserved to win the game. But yeah, Red certainly put up more of a fight than I'd expected upon seeing the score. And after the showing they gave against Shonan on the first day, again, way back when, maybe Reds will be a bit more adventurous this season and could start to realise some of the, I wouldn't say potential maybe, but you know, answer some of the expectations that are placed on them to be a team that are up there challenging for trophies rather than trying to stave off the threat of relegation.
That Nakagawa and Eric moment, I think, was the best bit about having no fans in the stadium, because you could actually hear the rollicking that was given to Eric for not passing that ball. So, yeah, that was quite amusing. But I really enjoyed the game. Yeah, it was a good nil-nil. Red surprised me, really, with the team selection was kind of like I don't want to be unfair to them, but it was kind of a workman-like team. It was a team that were there to put the effort in, put in the hard yards. Sean mentioned, Leonardo wasn't there. You've got Kashiwagi on the bench, Muto on the bench, these kind of more creative players. But the players that are on there just work their socks off, and they gave as good as they got. Obviously, you're not going to have the ball for a long period against Yokohama, but you have to then be a threat on the counter-attack, and they definitely were. I mean, they owed a little bit to Nishikawa for some good saves, especially towards the end, but I thought Reds played really well and were deserving of the points, in my opinion. And it'd be interesting to see if they now just going to rotate their team completely for Sendai, and then when they think they can probably express themselves a little bit more and bring in the likes of Kashiwagi and Everton in midfield and Leonardo up front. But if, for the way it worked against Yokohama, I thought it was perfect. And Yokohama, that's his two games now without a victory to start the season. Again, I don't think they looked quite as sharp as they were last season, which is completely understandable, of course, but they got into good positions, and then either, like Eric, the decision-making was poor, or the final effort wasn't quite up to scratch. I'm sure they'll get there in the end, but yeah, I thought Reds very worthy of a point in this game.
Well, yeah, hopefully they can wait another three games before they hit their stride, because they actually host FC Tokyo in match day four. So if if they don't mind waiting to click into gear until at least match day five, then that would be very agreeable to myself. But Sam, I'll just come back to you for another thought on Yokohama. We wondered how Yuji Kajikawa would go in goal, replacing Park Il-gyu. He was tested a couple of times in the first half by Koya Yuruki, who was, as Sean's mentioned a little bit earlier, and also Kazuki Nagasawa. So, well, I guess he's kept a clean sheet, so he's at least passed his audition.
Yeah, I mean, he generally played quite well in the Champions League games earlier in the year. And yeah, from what he had to do in this game, he did very well. It was a surprising round, actually, in Japan, in J1 at least, where the goalkeeping as a whole was terrific. And I don't think I've ever said that before, but Kajikawa was good in this game, as was Nishikawa. And we'll come on to some of the younger goalkeepers and Langerak in the Nagoya game. But yeah, a really good performance from a lot of goalkeepers. And Kajikawa, yeah, very good. He did everything that was asked of him. And I mean, Park's a very good goalkeeper himself, but I don't think it's going to be that detrimental to Yokohama to have Kajikawa in goal for any length of time.
Yes, indeed. And yeah, Kajikawa's the opposite number. He has been mentioned already in this discussion. But yeah, Shusaku Nishikawa preserved a point for Reds deep into stoppage time with a stunning reaction save to keep out Edgar Junior's deflected low drive. So yeah, the points shared at the Saitama Stadium. Reds doing enough, but also yeah, doing enough going forward to fill their supporters with optimism, I think, for the season ahead. We know it can't have gotten much worse than it was last year, and they've definitely made a positive start. Yeah, winning away at Shonan on the opening day, and then holding the defending champions and giving them a good game in the process in match day two. All right, well, now we're kind of jumping around a bit, but we're going to head back to the in inverted commas at Western group of games and clubs by talking about Shimizu 1, Nagoya 2, and the first of one of the young goalkeepers that Johnny Nicol wanted us to talk about, young Togo Umeda, made his first J1 start for S-Pulse as Sean goes about his business at at home there. Obviously terrific for Umeda to get this initial performance under his belt. The only unfortunate thing, Sam, was that an own goal 5 minutes before halftime ultimately decided this game, and Umeda played his part in it.
Yeah, I mean, that was quite unfortunate. It was a really good ball in from into that corridor of uncertainty between goalkeeper and defender. I don't think he dealt with it as well as he could have done. But, yeah, I mean, you get those. It was quite unlucky for him. And I think his head kind of went a little bit towards the end of that first half. I think shortly afterwards he went sprinting out for a ball that was over the top and getting nowhere near it. But otherwise, I thought he played really well. I mean, the first Nagoya goal was so unfortunate for Umeda. He made a terrific save from Joe Schmidt onto the crossbar to start with. Then it was a double save reacting to the header from Schmidt, and it was just so unfortunate for him that Sommer was on hand to tap it home. But I thought he did really well, considering he was just chucked in at the deep end here when they lost Neto Volpi, their main goalkeeper. Nishibe is also injured, the really experienced goalkeeper. And Okubo was on the bench, but he himself is just coming back from injury. So he was just chucked in at the deep end. And I thought, for a J-League debut, I thought he did as well as he could have done. And he grew in the second half as well after the mistake and kind of, yeah, he looked more at home as the game went on. So I thought he had a pretty good game.
And, I mean, along with Alan's question from before, I mean, yeah, obviously the Espos could feel aggrieved at one of the Nagoya goals appearing to come from Naoki Maeda receiving the ball in an offside position. But as you said earlier, that was much more line ball than the Taniguchi one.
Yeah, it was really tight. I've paused it at the time it was released, and it's one of those where he might be a half a toenail offside, but it's not anything clear cut. And I like to see when it's that tight, the benefit of the doubt go to the attacker. So I'm not too unhappy that was allowed to continue. Although Shimizu fans might completely disagree with that.
I reckon they probably do, yeah. Sean, Shimizu were one of the teams we were kind of bigging up towards the end of the lockdown. We wondered whether all this time for new manager Peter Klimovsky to work with his players and install his Ange Ball methods might see Espols get off to a flying start. And to be fair, they obviously did. They took the lead here in the 18th minute through Shota Kaneko when he nicked the ball off Yao Schmidt and finished off the move after being set up by Yusuke Goto. And, I mean, the Grampus were indebted to Mitch Langerak for keeping it at 1-0 before, yeah. For Espols, from an Espols perspective, a Grampus then scored two fairly lucky goals in the space of 8 minutes, and that was that. But from the highlights, what did you think of the early days of Klimovsky ball at Nihon Daira?
I think it's quite similar to the early days of Ange Ball in Yokohama. I think the issues will be in defence. Marinos will still concede goals. I think against Gamba at the start of the season, then one of the goals they conceded was from playing it around at the back, and that is a hazard that comes with playing the way that Postecoglou wants his teams to, and it seems that Klimovsky also wants his to play. I mean, we've mentioned that there was an incredibly young goalkeeper there, and it doesn't matter who's in goal. If the defence if the defensive line is as bad as it was for, I think it was the own goal. Like, watching that back was not pretty, and you just think it doesn't matter who's in goal. If there's no one in front of you keeping things organised, if there isn't a solid setup there, you're going to concede. And it does seem like Klimovsky, similarly to Postecoglou, is more concerned with almost playing kind of, obviously not the same style of football, but playing with that same approach as Alex Ferguson had with Man United in the 90s, where it was, we'll just score one more goal than the other team. We're not gonna keep a clean sheet probably, but we'll score one more than them. And it does seem like that going forward, they were moving the ball around nicely. They've got some good attacking players in the midfield. They've got some tidy players, but yeah, defensively they didn't look especially solid. So yeah, you feel a bit sorry when you've got Is he a teenager still?
Yes,
maybe.
I believe he's 18. I believe he's 18. Possibly. Yeah, I think so.
18.
Well, okay. Well, there you go. Yeah, if you've got an 18-year-old in goal and you haven't got a really solid defence in front of him, you leave them open really. And I think he made, as we said, there was the own goal, which was just a mess all round. And I think the defence, some of the marking, I think, I don't remember who it was who played the ball in for Nagoya, but I think it might have been Mateus, who obviously Klimovsky should have known all about from having had him at Marinos last year. You can't afford to give him that much time on the edge of the box to work out, right, what am I going to do here? I think actually that might have been for the goal where the keeper made a couple of great saves and then the third one went in. That kind of, having that kind of disorganisation in front of you can't help any goalkeeper. But yeah, I think they played some nice stuff. They matched Nagoya, which is, Nagoya have got some very, very good attacking players, and they more than matched them going forward. One of Shimizu's Brazilians, whose name has completely escaped me now because they've got about 14, he had a great chance to make it 2-0, and I think Mitch Langerak just about got a touch on it and tipped it over the bar. And, if that goes in, again, everything could have gone differently, but if you don't make it 2-0 and then you get pegged back, and then the game goes completely differently. And I'll just add, for listeners, you mentioned me going about my business there. If anyone can guess what I was doing, they win they win something, whatever you've got lurking around in JTalk Pod Towers.
Okay. Answers on a postcard, please, listeners. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And apologies to Togo Umeda and his family. He is 19 years old, and he will come of age in about 2 weeks. His birthday's on the 23rd of July. So, yeah, he's just about to come of age, but yeah, you might say he came of age between the sticks on Saturday, and that is a horrible cliche, and I apologise for it. Sean, yeah, it's Carlinhos you were thinking of, the Brazilian who tested... Right. Langerak, but yeah, as we wrap up this game, it was obviously great to see Langerak back to his best after his much publicised brush with COVID-19, and the other other Grampus player to be publicly acknowledged to have suffered from COVID-19. And Mu Kanazaki came off the bench with a half an hour to go at Nihon Daira. So as yet, Sam, we don't know whether Mu is the right man to replace Joe. But, yeah, we'll find out, I'm sure, in the coming weeks. And, yeah, the last thing on this game, if anyone can tell me, again, answers on a postcard, listeners, what Yuki Soma did to get sent off in the 96th minute is absolutely beyond me. I obviously watched the highlights of every game today in preparation for this this podcast. I had watched the FC Tokyo game in full. But, yeah, there's a coming together out on the left-hand touchline as Soma looks to basically kill the clock. He's basically fouled in the 95th slash heading into the 96th minute. Yeah, the ball goes into the corner. The referee gives a free kick to Shimizu, and then the next thing you know, Valdo has been booked, and Soma has been booked. Well, that's his second yellow card, so he's sent off. So I was intrigued by this. I went back and went through I didn't watch the whole game, obviously, but I went into the full game package on DAZN and, yeah, tried to watch from basically the last couple of minutes on and couldn't see anything. There's no indication on the video of anything that Soma has done to get sent off. So I don't know if it's a reaction to the tackle that saw him upended, but yeah, if you know, listeners, I can't ask you if you were there because nobody was there, but if anyone happens to know, if there's something written in the Japanese press about it, I don't know, and you can fill us in, because that's one of life's great mysteries for me now, Sam. I don't suppose you could shed any light on it, can you?
I wish I could. I have no idea what went on. I was the same as you. I knew the red card was coming, so I assumed after Udvaldi must have lashed out or gone to the referee or something, but he doesn't seem to, from what I've seen. I just, yeah, it seemed very strange. I've not seen any other angle, and obviously there's no fan footage to tell, so I think it just might be one of those mysteries, and Soma has the midweek off.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Sorry, I'll just jump in there if I can. I'm just, as you said, that I remember... I watched the highlights too and wondered. And as you said that, I've just brought up the official report that JD put out on their kind of, what's it called, the media channel or something. And his second yellow card was apparently for C3, which is dissent.
Right.
His first one was for unsporting behaviour and his second one was for dissent. So he must have said something to the referee, I suppose. But yeah, he looked perplexed as well. So whether how the referee could miss here, because there's no fans in the stadium making the noise. So unless someone was doing an impression of him, but yeah, that's the official reason given on the score sheet, is the second yellow was for dissent. So yeah. That's all I can contribute.
I very much appreciate you clearing that up for us, Sean. That's absolutely terrific. Because, yeah, I would have just been wandering around for days wondering what Soma did. And now we know. So that's absolutely terrific. Thank you.
That sounds like a good title for a novel. What Soma did.
Most definitely. In the age of Corona, you always have to add that little caveat on the end.
Course,
yes, indeed.
Yeah. That can be the first line of the novel. It was the age of Corona.
Most definitely, yeah. Somebody didn't get that copyrighted, and now they're paying the price for it. Anyway, all right. Well, yes, we talked about Umeda making his debut for Shimizu, and also making his debut between the sticks for Vegalta Sendai was young Yuma Obata, who I do know is actually 18 years old. So I'm confident I've got that one right. And Obata was able to celebrate a victory in his first ever G1 start for Vegalta Sendai when, yeah, his side returned from the BMW Stadium in Hiratsuka with all 3 points after a 1-0 win over Shonan. This goal was, for some, I guess this is a goal of the season contender. I tend to like goals, crossed in from the touchline. But, Real German, he doesn't really know much about it, but he's crossed in from the right, basically from the edge of the box. And it looks basically like the wind has picked this up and carried it into the net past, the Shonan keeper, who was a little bit perplexed by the entire thing, I think. So, that came in just the third minute, Sam. So, a Bel Mare supporter with both eyes open would realise that, while they were unfortunate to go behind so early, they had so much time to get back into the game. But, unfortunately, as happened in their opening game at home against Urawa, they've come out on the wrong end of an odd goal scoreline again.
Yeah, I was wondering if we were going to have a debate about whether this was a cross or a shot, so I'm glad you've seen the light on this one. But, yeah, I mean, Shonan will be really disappointed with the way they played. Obata looked solid for what he had to do, but he didn't really have to do a lot. He could have brought a deck chair to the game and have been pretty comfortable. I think Shonan were reduced to a couple of long-range efforts, but nothing that really tested the goalkeeper. Sendai, after scoring the cross, didn't really offer anything either. I mean, last week, I think we had this down as one of the two games that just you could probably skip them, and so it proved. I think the J-League managed to get 3 minutes out of the highlights, which is impressive to get 3 minutes out of it. But, yeah, it was a really poor game and two fairly average teams, I'm afraid.
Indeed. So, Sendai will be wrapped to return home with all 3 points. So, Sean, I won't force you into a comment on this game where not an enormous amount happened after the third minute. But I'll refer you to Johnny's the first question actually of his email, which wanted us to discuss Obata and Umeda. So, how did you think both of them performed? And Johnny asked a really interesting question. Do you think we'll see teams rotating goalkeepers in a similar way to outfielders this year with the games obviously coming thick and fast?
I didn't see a huge amount of the, like as Sam said, the highlights for the Shonan Sendai game were few and far between. And I think from the stats I saw, Sendai had more shots than Shonan, which, you know, if you're at home against a Takashi Kiyama team and you get outshot, you know you've not done very well. He's a fairly reserved coach who likes to set his teams up solidly and then hope for something on the break, which they got with that, as we've mentioned, a slightly lucky goal. I think if that happens, it's kind of like in tennis when a serve kind of clips the net and goes in, you win the point. You're supposed to put your hand up and kind of apologise to the opponent for the luck. And I think Jermaine probably should have done that because there's just no way he's taking a shot there. So, Obata wasn't really tested too much. And I think, with regards to a team's going to rotate the goalkeepers, I don't know. I think the teams that have got something to play for, probably not, because you still want to keep consistency. And I think that level of communication between the goalkeeper and the defence is key to building a solid team. So the teams that are looking to win the league or looking to get in the ACL, I think they'll probably try to go with some consistency. But for the teams, once you get beyond maybe the halfway point in terms of matches played, if teams have got nothing to play for, you know, why not all over the pitch? Why not give players the chances? If you're playing Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday, you've got 6, 7, 8 games in a month. Why not give, you know, the 18, 19-year-old goalkeepers, why not give the younger player? This is something that is still a standout in Japan, that players of this age don't get minutes. And you look at Europe and they do. Players in, you know, late teens are in the first team. They're playing regularly. They're getting minutes and they're establishing themselves and they're making that step up. And I still surprise myself every year when I think of a player as being young because he's only, you know, played one full season or a couple of seasons in and around the squad. And you look at his age and he's already 24. And I think this should give give coaches the opportunity to try and break down those barriers a bit and get rid of the hierarchy that does exist. And, you know, you're going to be playing so many matches. Give these players chances, because, you know, they can do it. They can play at that level. The better J League teams obviously are at a different level, but there's a lot of teams that are at a similar level. And if you let the players get over that psychological barrier of feeling like playing in the first team is a big deal. If you can get them playing, you know, into the double figures of starts over the course of this season, where there's nothing to lose, there's nothing. Teams can't go down. So maybe, you know, Kiyama has thought that this year. Well, Sendai usually, maybe their target is to avoid relegation and see how far up they can finish. Maybe he's looking at it and going, well, I've got a year now. He's a new coach to the team. He's got a year to maybe try and to bring through some players that he'll be able to use in the next 2-3 years as well. So why not give these players confidence and let them ingratiate themselves in the team? So whether coaches will do it, I don't know, but I don't see why not. A goalkeeper is obviously a slightly tricky position, but then again, you can't get relegated. So why not give the guy half a dozen, 10 games and let him, you know, feel what it's like to play out there, especially once fans are back in the stadium and, you know, playing alongside the first is different. It does give the players a different feeling, and I think it will help give them confidence. So if I was a coach, I would certainly do it. But yeah, I think you might see a bit of a divide between teams that are playing to win something and teams that are just playing because it's, you know, it's almost a contractual obligation that they need to play all their games for the season.
I agree, especially the teams that are towards the top of the table. I don't think they're going to change it, and I think goalkeeper is not going to change like a left winger would or something like that. I think even if you're trying to, it doesn't matter if you're getting relegated, if you're building for next season, I think that goalkeeper and centre-back partnership is so crucial. I'd like to try and develop that if I could, if I was a manager. But I think the positive, especially if we look at Sendai with Obata coming in, because Slovic's the number one goalkeeper, so if he's fit, he's going to play. But I thought it was really promising that they put in the young goalkeeper rather than going with maybe Kentaro Seki, who's played a lot of J-League football, he's quite experienced, or even Goro Kawanami, that he's played maybe 10 or so J-League games, I'd say, and a bit more experience, but they had faith in the youngster. So I think if we see injuries going further, I think teams might be more inclined to go with a younger option rather than maybe a 33-year-old big part squad player. So hopefully that will come in as the season goes on. But I think generally you're going to see the main goalkeeper for most of the teams, and the rotation will come probably in more of the forward areas than anywhere else. So I just think that centre-back and goalkeeper partnership is so crucial. And yeah, like Sendai will take this season as a free hit, but they'll have eyes on getting into the top half of the table, I'm sure, because why would you have sacked Susumu Watanabe, who was always getting them pretty much 11th, if that was the only place they wanted to go? So I think they're going to have to look to build, and I think goalkeeper is such a crucial position that such rotation I don't think is going to be too commonplace, but hopefully young goalkeepers will get a few chances in case of injuries, or if they, yeah, maybe towards the end of the season, give them a few games.
All right, terrific stuff. So thanks for that other part of your email, Johnny. Thanks again to Alan and Daniel for their questions in this episode as well. So yeah, a winning debut between the sticks for Sendai for Yuma Obata, and one really impressive save from Toichi Suzuki's curler from the edge of the box just before half time. So that definitely got his feet wet in J1, and generally an assured debut from Obata. All right, well, we had one more game to review then, and it's Oita versus Tosu, the Kyushu derby down in Oita. Obviously, we send our best to all the victims of the flooding down in Kumamoto. Again, those people down there have suffered so much in the last couple of years with the, of course, the huge earthquake as well. And now to be hit with really devastating flooding is, heartbreaking to see. But we're sending our best to everyone down there. Oita won the Kyushu Derby 2-0 thanks to a brace from Tatsuya Tanaka. No, not the former Urawa Reds player. Another Tatsuya Tanaka who scored two terrific goals that, the other Tatsuya Tanaka would have been very proud of, I'm sure. After a goalless first half, Tanaka headed in a superb cross in from the left from Yuki Kagawa in the 66th minute. And then he wrapped up the points with a minute left after a superb first-time volleyed through ball from Kazushi Mitsuhira. So two terrific assists and, two good finishes from Tanaka. A header and a clipped finish past the Tosu keeper. So, Sean, you've kind of drawn the short straw here. I didn't come to you about the Sean Unsendai game first, so I'll have to flip the script here and see if you've got any pearls of wisdom to share with us on Oita 2, Tosu 0.
I'm happier to take this than the previous game. That was the one I was dreading. I think as you said, he took both goals well, but the marking for the header was absolutely abysmal. I mean, I think he's about 5'4" or something. He's not the tallest bloke. So to have him score a header against you is not ideal. And when I was watching the highlights and when I first saw he scored a header, I thought, how the hell did you let him score a header? And then watching it back, like, he was just sort of stood on the edge of the 6-yard box. Whether the centre backs also thought, well, he's tiny, he's not going to score a header. But, and yeah, the ball in was good. But I mean, he was just stood there, sort of waiting for the ball. And neither of the centre backs thought to pick him up. That wasn't ideal. And there's been a lot of sort of doom and gloom around Tosu ahead of the season. And sort of when I looked at their squad ahead of the opening weekend, I thought, well, actually, they've got a few decent players in there. Daiki Mia they brought in at centre-back, and Eduardo were like, you know, they're steady enough in the J-League. They brought in Koyamatsu from Kyoto and I think Uchida from Tokushima Vortis as well. They brought in some decent players from J2 last year. They've got Thiago Alves as well up front, who did very well at Shimizu a couple of years ago. So I thought, well, they've got enough to really, they could still be a sort of steady enough mid-table side. But yeah, they just didn't really offer a huge amount. And yeah, if your defence is that poor, Oita are a nice side and they play some good football. And I think, yeah, obviously they surprised everybody last season. But I think, yeah, they should be there or thereabouts in comfortable mid-table this year. They play nice stuff and they've got good, they've got some good individual players, but also a bit similarly to Hiroshima. Everyone knows what they're supposed to be doing. They've got a set style of football and then they play it every week. So I think they'll be fine. But yeah, they were certainly given a little bit of a helping hand by some fairly shoddy defending.
Indeed. Well, yeah, Sam, this was the only game I predicted a 0-0 in the transfer market prediction game, but not for the first time. I underestimated Oita.
Yeah, well, I mean, they played against Sagan Tosu, who kind of gifted them that first goal, and they didn't have to do too. It was a good ball, the second one, but it was fairly comfortable for them to get through. I don't think, yeah, Sagan were all over the place defensively, and Oita had just a bit of more quality that I think Tanaka came on and kind of invigorated the team. They looked a little bit more lively second half. Yeah, and it was a good ball as well from Kagawa, as you mentioned, but yeah, Sagan, I think the Sagan nil was as clear as you're going to get, and I think that'll be the case for a lot of games this season. Going forward, they really didn't offer too much. They were a bit like Shonan when they were restricted to long-range efforts. Like, Thiago Alves was shooting from literally anywhere if he could see the goal, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't testing the goalkeeper at all. But Takagi did make a couple of decent saves from long-range efforts, but realistically, Sagan did not create anything clear-cut or anywhere near clear-cut, and it's going to be difficult to see where they're going to get a sustained amount of goal threat, because with Kamazaki gone, they played Renzo Lopez up front for the first half, and you might as well not have played anyone up front. And then there are other options. I mean, they've got Toyota, who, yeah, I mean, serviceable at the moment. He's not the player he was three or four years ago. I mean, Cho Dong-yeon's an okay striker at best. I mean, they played Hayashi, I think it was, who came on for the second half. But even he just didn't look like scoring. I think Tosu could have played another couple of hours and still wouldn't have come close to scoring. So there's going to be a lot of worries for them going forward. And if they're defending as poorly as they had done in this game, then yeah, it's going to be another miserable few months for Sagan Tosu fans.
All right then. Well, yes, that is all the nine games from J1 Match Day 2 rounded up, listeners. All that's left for us to do is to talk about what's coming up in the next few days before our next episode. Match day 3 will take place with all 9 games being played on Wednesday, and 2 derbies highlight the fixture list there. The Kanagawa Derby between the Yokohama F. Marinos and Shonan will be played at Mitsuzawa in suburban Yokohama. And, of course, the Tamagawa Classico with the FC Tokyo hosting Kawasaki Frontale will be played behind closed doors at Ajinomoto Stadium. And, well, interesting enough, guys, as regular listeners will know and regular followers of Japanese football will know, from this coming weekend, actually from Friday night, when there is a J2 game scheduled with Okayama hosting Kita Kyushu, fans will be allowed back in the stadiums, and not in their droves, of course, but in limited numbers. So a J1 match day 4 takes place over the weekend. There are 2 games on Saturday, highlighted by Kawasaki hosting Kashiwa at Todoroki, and the other 7 games on Sunday, with probably the pick of them, Kashima's trip to Urawa and the clash of last season's top 2, Yokohama F. Marinos hosting FC Tokyo, this time at the Nissan Stadium. So fans are going to be allowed back in from this weekend. What do we know, or what do you know, about whether there will be an expanded media presence at J-League games? Because as some listeners might know, I think there's been a limit of 25 pen media allowed into stadiums this past weekend, which limits the opportunities for freelancers like yourself. So what do you know about when you might be allowed back into J-League stadiums?
I've not heard anything different. As you said, it's been limited to 25 pen, as they call them, pen journalists, written journalists, and with the way they do things in Japan, there are several categories that come above freelancer. They have what's called like a press club, and then there's the established newspapers, and then there's the sports newspapers, and then, you know, I think my category was around about 5th. For the big games in Kanto, it's impossible. They'd also kind of ask people not to apply unless you absolutely had to go to games, and there was, you know, all these kind of stipulations around it. You had to fill out a questionnaire, and you had to tell them your temperature and whatever from the 10 days leading up to the game, and there were so many hoops to jump through. And at the moment, there's no access to the players or the coaches after matches. They're doing press conferences on Zoom, which we can access remotely anyway. And although they're incredibly short now, because everyone has to be out of the venues within an hour of the game finishing, there's been very little need for me to go to stadiums. Usually I like to go because you get a chance to speak to the players after the game, and without being able to do that, there's, you know, DAZN stream pending. I can usually watch the games at home safely enough. So I've not heard any updates as to them increasing the number of journalists. Whether something will be announced or sent out to us in the next day or two, now that they've committed to letting in 5,000 fans at least, or 5,000 fans at the most, sorry, to games from Friday, I don't know. But again, even if they are, for the time being, for me, and unless I can speak to players or coaches while at the stadium, I probably would just stick to watching games from home. It's sometimes easier, you know, watching a match in full from home. You get the replays, the different camera angles, the stats, you know, that are flashed up on screen, and the input from the commentators and whatnot watching, which sometimes can give you a different angle on the game and things that you miss out on at the stadium. Obviously, if they say that it's a free for all again, and as many people, many journalists as want can go to games, I'd much prefer to be out there at the stadiums watching them. But if it's not going to benefit me work-wise, and if there's still going to be a limit and other journalists need to be there on the ground watching games, then I'm happy for the time being to keep watching them from home. But yeah, ideally, you know, I'd like to be back out there, but again, it's with the caveat that I can get some access to speak into the players and coaches again. Otherwise, there's little need to be there.
Yeah, hopefully he can get back there as soon as possible, but it's great to have them 5,000 fans coming back in this weekend. But I was just wondering if you'd heard anything about a possible delay to that, especially in the Tokyo area, because there's been quite a few, well, a few spikes in their coronavirus cases. So is there any threat that just for that region, for example, there might be a couple of weeks delay on them getting supporters back into the ground?
I think from what I saw that was announced today, they've said they're still going ahead with the plan to let the fans in, including in sort of Tokyo and the greater Tokyo region. Murai said that they will be keeping an eye on government announcements and things. So I would assume that means that if in the next, we're talking obviously on Monday night, if within the next couple of days, there's suddenly another spike and the government issues some stricter, we never had a lockdown here as such, but if they issue any stricter rules with regards to that, with regards to gathering in big groups, and the J-League feel that their hand's been forced, they've sort of given themselves that little bit of wiggle room to say, look, we can't do it, we're really sorry, but we're going to have to go with no fans again. But it seems at the moment as if they want to go ahead with it. They've said, you know, the players, the coaches, the journalists and everyone have been sort of, they've gone along with all the requests and made sure that the environment has been safe, and they're asking that fans do the same and don't go to games if they're not feeling well, that they sort of follow the social distancing rules if and when they do go to games. Personally, I don't really understand why they're still intent on rushing through. You know, we've been through 4 months of no football. There's only been one round of J1 games, and there's would have been two rounds of J2, I think. Well, it would have been two rounds of J1 with the midweek, but, you know, two rounds of each league. Why not have another few rounds, another couple of weeks or a month, and just see how the land lies? There's no need to rush it, really. Fans are kind of now resigned to not being there for the time being. So I think everyone's kind of gotten over that. I wouldn't quite say it was a shock, because it's happened all around the world. But, you know, fans have gotten over that initial hurdle of not being able to go. So there's personally, I wonder why they're still intent on going back, especially in Tokyo, where the numbers are creeping back up again. But yeah, as at the time we speak now, that's what they're intending on doing. So yeah, I agree with you. It'd be great to have some fans back in the stadium. I'm not a fan of this piping noise in or putting cardboard cutouts of people's cats up in the stadium. I just think it's all a bit odd. So it'd be great to have some real humans in there again. But yeah, the main thing is making sure that there's a safe environment and that this, we don't see a big spike and we don't set ourselves back a couple of months. So yeah, it seems a little bit odd, but that's what they're doing, and they're getting advice from people who've got a lot more expertise and information about it than me. So I guess we have to just hope that they're making the right decision.
Yeah, and just one more question, if you don't mind. I'm just wondering about travel, especially if fans are coming back in. Is there a limit on away fans, or is there no away fans at all for these first games with 5,000? And is there a later date when they want to bring in away fans?
I think I'm right in saying there are no away fans, and I think they've kept that fairly vague as to when they're going to reintroduce that, but I'm fairly certain that a couple of months ago, in amongst the deluge of announcements they were making, I'm fairly certain they did say at that point that games would go ahead without away fans initially, even if those away fans happen to live in the region. You know, if you're from Sapporo and you happen to work in Tokyo, you can't go along. They're not going to be checking people's residence cards, asking where they live. Going on having away fans. That was the latest that I remember hearing from the J-League. That might well have changed, although I'd be surprised, bearing in mind how things are now. And Tokyo announced a kind of advisory ban on travelling out of the region in the last couple of days because of the spike in cases here and not wanting it to spread further afield. So my educated guess is that that's still the case, but I don't know 100% on that.
Yeah, I think their intention, Sam, was to try and allow away fans back in from the 1st of August, I think, when the regions are basically done with in J1, and you know, teams from the in inverted commas north and east areas can play teams from the west and south. And I think that was when they were tentatively going to allow away fans back in. But yeah, I don't think that's been cast in stone yet. And yeah, when it comes to the situation in Tokyo, yeah, I mean, we've had numerous days of consecutive now with over 100 new cases. But yeah, I mean, FC Tokyo are pushing ahead with getting fans back into Ajinomoto Stadium. For the life of me, I can't remember the date of the game, but yeah, an upcoming home game against Urawa. They have yeah, advertised on Facebook that they're going to start selling tickets. So yeah, that does appear to be going ahead in the nation's capital. Yeah, despite the reservations that Sean has, and I definitely echo as well, with the situation seemingly getting worse. All right, well, I think we will leave it there for this week. Sean, the last time you were on after a J1 match day, everything shut down for 4 months. So let's hope it doesn't happen again after match day two and in between match day three on Wednesday night. But as always, it was absolutely terrific to get your thoughts on everything J1. And it definitely won't be 4 months before we do it again. Great to speak with you again.
Yeah, fingers crossed it's not another 4 months. And yeah, look forward to speaking to you both again soon.
Terrific stuff. All right, Sam, we're going to have to get our heads down and decide what we're going to do with all these midweek games coming up. I know you are the busiest man in show business, of course, with all your yeah, requirements at Football Radar. But yeah, the games definitely start coming thick and fast from this Wednesday. So get your head down and yeah, we'll try and arrange a time to speak again early next week to wrap up match days three and four.
Yeah, sounds good. I'm looking forward to it and dreading it all at the same time. But yeah, I'll try and get some sleep at some point.
All right, then. So that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk Podcaster. Thanks ever so much to Sean Carroll for his time, and to Alan Gibson, Johnny Nicol, and Daniel Hartman for their questions. Thanks, of course, as always, to you for listening wherever you are. Yeah, we'll be back next week to wrap up match days 3 and 4 of the J1 season. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.